Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Yes, you've come to the right place. This is Burning Down the House on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. This is your weekly dose of everything related to the built environment, design, architecture, and the creative arts. And I'm very pleased this week to have as our guest John Hill, who's an author, but most importantly, he is an architect. He is a real architect. He is a registered and licensed architect. Welcome to Heritage Radio Network, John.
Thanks for having me.
Very good. John is not just an architect, but he is also a researcher and a writer. He's got a couple of tasty blogs. Tell us about your blogs.
Well, the first one I started is called A Weekly Dose of Architecture. That dates back to 1999. And simply a weekly dose being I write about a project and a book every week. And Daily Dose of Architecture, which followed about 5 years after that, and it's a daily blog, less formal in terms of structure, but they, at their heart have architecture as their focus.
Now, which one of those is archidose.org?
That is just a page that then links to the different pages,
because
there's also the Architourist, which I started in 05, and that's a wiki page, so lots of people can contribute. But basically, when you get there, you'll have a choice: which one do I want to go look at? And then once you're on those pages, there's links back and forth.
Wow, I didn't realize you were so multifaceted. That's fantastic. I just knew about Archidose.
The weekly one?
Yeah.
That was the first one. I still, in some ways I could get rid of it and just have the daily dose because that's the most trafficked, but, it was the first one I did, so it's kind of dear to me, so I just, I keep that separation.
Cool. But more important is that John is the author of, I guess it's the Guide to Contemporary New York City Architecture. Who published this?
W.W. Norton.
Norton, that's a serious publisher.
Yeah.
That's great. You didn't just do this through Lulu or something.
No. They do a lot of New York guides. So that's kind of how it happened, because they've done public art, they've done MAS walking tours and so forth.
Excellent. You're quite a live wire. That's good. Maybe we don't have to just do the intro and take a break. But what I wanted to talk about in no particular order today is your writing.
Okay.
Your research, how you found out about all of these different buildings. There's so much information here in the guide. I'm highly impressed. I really am.
Thanks.
Another topic is your experience in the Great Depression version 2.0, during which many of us found that we had not enough work to do.
Yeah.
I guess your solution was to write this fabulous book.
That's part of it, yeah.
I myself wrote a novel, which I haven't been able to sell yet, but it kept me sane, which is an important thing, because when we're creative people, if we don't have a project to do, it's not so good.
I hear you.
Thoughts about the contemporary environment of New York right now. A lot of these are boom projects,
right?
That took a while to get finished, and we might talk about what happens next. Mm-hmm. I might ask you which of any of these might be some of your favorite projects.
Okay.
Then I might want to just talk about the state of our profession in general. Let's take a couple of minutes before we launch into our journey with a little bit of a musical break. Back with John Hill. Did you all dig that dance music? That was Buddha Bar. Love that kind of Middle Eastern stuff. Even though I'm a son of the prairie. Before the episode started, John and I were just talking. I've discovered that we're both sons of the great state of Illinois.
Yep, indeed.
You know how you can tell someone who's not from Illinois?
How?
They pronounce it Illinois.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not Illinois?
No. Well, Illinois, throw him off the bus for that. No, I discovered that I was coming back from Toronto, and there was this guy at the American customs counter, and he didn't even look at you. He just listened to, he just asked you, where were you born? Mm-hmm. And I said, I was born in Chicago, Illinois. And he said, come right in, Mr. Wayne.
Okay.
It's very interesting. You're the most laid-back person from Illinois I think I've ever met.
Oh, really?
You must have spent some time out west somewhere or something.
No.
Or your childhood was exceptionally delightful.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah. See, when I was 11, my parents moved us to the East Coast, and then I got all edgy and everything.
No, didn't move out here till 2006.
Oh, my
it's
God.
It's still sinking in, I guess.
Well, good for you. Just hold on to the cool. So, you've been a practicing architect.
Yeah.
Previous to the Great Depression version 2.0.
Yeah.
Did you work here in the city?
For a little while. I mean, most of my experience is in Chicago. I worked at a large firm, DiStefano and Partners.
Sure.
And speaking of, if you want to call it the Great Depression 2.0, they fizzled last year. They were 60 when I started in 97. When I left, they were a little bit bigger, but they had hit about a 140, 150 peak. And last year, maybe 20, 25 from what I heard, and they split into two firms. So
wow.
There's no more that namesake firm that I was with for about 10 years.
Yeah, I've discovered that there are lingering effects of this this ripple of capital markets, and that depression recession hits different areas at different times.
Mm-hmm.
Here in New York, because we're so closely aligned with the major construction lenders, when the Dow fell off the shelf in October 2008, all mayhem broke because we were directly dealing with the miscreants who caused it, people like Credit Suisse, for example.
Yeah.
And but we've also been faster to recover.
Right.
So when did you decide that you wanted to do a book like this? How did that come about?
Well, I think part of it was being out of work. I mean, I did, after I graduated from City College in 2007, I got an urban design, urban planning degree there. I worked for an architect for about a year and a half until the end of 08. And like any architect, I tried to find another job.
Sure.
In an architect's office. And, you know, I probably spent a good 3 to 6 months sending out, I don't know how many resumes a week. And if there were responses, it was either, you know, thank you, we're not hiring, or I did get two interviews and they weren't hiring. So it was just, they wanted to meet me. It was more for future reference.
Nice.
But I had been doing these other things, these web pages, since 99, and writing and making contacts, you know, just by virtue of keeping up with it. Not so much that I wanted to be a journalist or be considered a journalist or whatever. You know, I liked writing, but, you know, I still considered myself an architect. But then I thought, well, this is not going well, so why don't I try this other thing and see, is it going to pay the bills? Is it going to kind of get me over this hump, you know, however long it lasts? And, you know, it led to a little freelance writing, you know, trying more to make money on my web pages. With web pages, you can't make a ton of money, but you can get something back for the effort you put into it. And then
I've heard of bloggers being able to make at the most about $10,000 a year from hits.
That sounds good. I mean, you know, if you have various ways of making money. I mean, I have a few on my blog, but you know, they fluctuate. You know, they're based on hits and traffic. And you know, if you link up with Amazon based on if people are going to buy stuff when they click over.
Right.
You know, those sorts of things. So there's never, you don't, Christmas time, for example, you know, the Amazon check is nice, but the rest of the year it dribbles in, you know. And so, but that sounds like a good number. But then with the book, I had been reviewing books on my webpage for a while,
uh-huh.
And publishers, you know, these are books I would buy, and I just
sure.
like to kind of, it was more for my reference, not as a way to review them so you would know to buy it or not. It was more, I need to distill the ideas that are in this book, and this is a good way for me to do that, is just to kind of 500 words or so, just kind of extract from it and write down what I liked about it, what I got out of it, and the publishers noticed, so they started sending me books. And Norton, who had been doing, I mentioned before, Public Art Guide to New York that Gene Pfeiffer did, and MAS, Municipal Art Society Walking Tours by
yes.
Maroney and Postal, those I reviewed, and then I told the editor at Norton when I sent a link to my reviews, and I said, hey, if you ever want a contemporary architecture guide, I've been thinking about just self-publishing it, and they had an immediate response saying we're interested.
You just set that in blind?
Yeah.
You didn't have a person's name?
Well, the editor who sent me these books
uh-huh.
to be reviewed.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I knew somebody, but it was okay. on that level where I was kind of a way to get their books out there. But then... you know, this is Lady Andrea Costello Dawson. She helped me fashion a proposal. And that was very helpful. It wasn't just me blindly kind of writing stuff down and sending it out. We kind of worked together and did so for the whole process. But that was the immediate part when it happened the summer of 09. So
this book went pretty quickly.
Well, I finished at the end of 2010, so
oh,
I had it.
So it took a while to get to press.
Yeah.
So this came out in December of last year.
Yes.
In 2011.
Uh-huh. So they had it for about a year. Well, you know, there was early copies from where they got it printed coming in August, September.
So. Uh-huh. If it's not too intrusive to ask, did they give you an advance?
Yes.
That's nice. I'm glad.
Yeah. I mean, it was... It helped, You know, it was not something I could just, you know, sit back and not do other work. So, you know, I'd also, around that time, started a part-time job with a website. And then, you know, so I had a little bit of steady income. But, you know, had this and my blog and the freelance writing all kind of adding up to something.
But no architecture during that period?
No. No, and part of it was I'm registered in Illinois, and you know how the bureaucracy with NCARB and so on, and
yeah, of course.
You know, in Chicago, they were paying, the firm paid for all that. Moving to New York and being in school and then being out of school, you know, I even with a job, it was like, am I going to be paying all this money every year to maintain this record? If I'm working for an architect who's stamping the drawings.
Right, the NCARB record.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
and the,
yeah.
the certificate. So it's eventually got to the point where, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars I would have to pay to just move my licensure or to get licensed in New York as well.
Totally understand. We've talked about that at some length in other episodes mm-hmm. previous to this. NCARB gives, unfortunately, no indication that they're going to budge on any of their rules.
Although they were bugging me recently, saying we'll cut, I don't know if it was something in half to, you know, they basically, it was like getting something in the mail saying we want you back, you know.
Well, that's nice. I get those from the AIA once in a while.
Yeah.
Even though I'm presently working in a firm that's willing to pay my AIA fees.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even want to, well, we'll leave that alone for now. This is not an unusual lament that we have. You'd think that if you're doing the NCARB thing in the first place, that perhaps there could have been a national license with state endorsements.
Right, with IDP and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you're good enough to practice in Illinois or New York, well, back in the 20th century, when I moved from Illinois to New York, I didn't have to go through NCARB. Mm-hmm. New York was willing to accept an Illinois license as being equivalent because they were both using the same exams and had the same rules for internship.
Right.
And it was after I had two licenses that I got into the NCARB world and got a bunch of other licenses, which I didn't keep because then I didn't have projects, and
right.
And it could be very, very costly.
Yeah.
Just something that our colleagues in other countries don't quite understand, our federal system. I do want to talk about some of the interesting critical things you have to say in your guide. Let's have a little musical break. Burning Down the House, I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We're here with John Hill, architect and writer. I hope you enjoyed that critical music. That was March of the Nights from Prokofiev, Romeo and Juliet. Now that we're a 501(c), I'm supposed to announce the music that we use. So that's just what BMI would like, but, you know, I just do what I like to do because I'm an architect and we follow rules. One of the rules that some people seem to have in our profession, John, is don't criticize anybody because that would be rude.
Okay.
But I think it's wrong to comment on a project without actually talking about some of the issues. So I was happy to see in the book, and all of you in New York, you need to have this book. Those of you who are coming to New York, you need to get this book. It's The Guide to Contemporary New York City Architecture, W.W. Norton, 2011, John Hill. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it in your bookstores. Those of you here in New York City, you can either buy it on Amazon. You could go over to Van Allen. I know they've got it there.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's organized by projects, and then there are other things. It's just it's really kind of good. It reminds me of the kind of cookbooks that James Beard wrote back in the day, talking about different ways to cook without being overly pushy about an agenda. So here's Project 61, 211th Avenue, by Annabelle Seldorf, which is this very large project, which is mostly interesting because there are apartments that have their own garages, and it's a mid-rise building. And you, at the end, you do say, and to your credit, it needs to be noted, unfortunately, in Annabelle Seldorf's design for developer Peter Moore, the elevator and garages on the west facade are not expressed with a stainless steel or terracotta of the rest of the building, but rather they are hidden behind tinted glass and louvers.
Mm-hmm.
Well noted. I mean, that could have been a feature.
Yeah, and I think there, in some initial renderings, they showed like a trellis with plants or ivy or what have you, and that seemed to be maybe not a way of expressing it, but a way of perhaps offsetting this, the gas that, you know, these people are using.
Yeah.
Because they have this, now they have this amenity that it makes it easy for them to use it, you know, use a car.
Right.
Rather than walk, which is what the city is.
But the whole idea that you've got a building that also includes vertical transportation for vehicles, and it's not integral to the core of the building.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the edge, right?
Yeah.
It could have been expressed the way that the metabolists or even some of the brutalists would have expressed a totally different a movement system as a part of the composition.
Yeah. Well, even the facade that faces west towards Hudson River Park, it expresses, it has like a two-story expression. So you have these stainless steel every other floor with kind of a dark band in between. And yes, that gets at the fact these are duplexes, but when you look at a section, they're actually shifted relative to each other, because if they were aligned with each other, then the garage on one floor would have to serve both units.
Uh-huh.
But because you want living below bedrooms, they have to be shifted. So then there's this potential there as well, not that it needed to be done, but there is a potential there to express this sectional shift.
Right, the organization happening. Of that, of the building. Yeah. Well put. So as you were researching all of these different... I have to ask you, just to interrupt my own strain of thought here... And it's a strain, not a train, because it's not necessarily going in any direction. It's a filtering process. How did you decide which projects to include?
Well, actually, working with the editor and actually at the proposal stage, started to set up some fairly objective criteria, such as there need to be some public aspect to the building, and I wanted to include landscape so as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be an interior, but it needed to be publicly accessible. So it needed to be like a facade on a street, a public space, and also to be long-term or to be intended for the long-term. Mm-hmm. You know, that meant that retail and restaurants, while they kind of exhibit the most recent trends in architecture, they come and go so quickly in New York that I only included a few in these sidebars, not part of the main 200 entries that comprise the majority of the book. But anyways, there were those somewhat objective criteria, and then it was just a lot of personal preference, visiting the buildings and just, you know, seeing if I liked it or not, or in some way, but also is there maybe a little story behind it or something that goes beyond just the way it looks.
It's interesting that you didn't want to talk about ephemera, but you do have eating in style.
Yeah, like I was saying, I did include some retail and some restaurants. Although I tried to pick ones that had been around for a little while, so they did have some staying power to begin with.
Right, like Brasserie. I happen to like Brasserie, the DSNR project, because it's fun.
Yeah. I wish the video thing still worked.
Yeah. Well, when for those of you who might never come to New York, when you enter the vestibule, originally there were television cameras, and for just a brief moment, you were a TV star, because over the bar were video monitors, and everybody at the bar could see who was coming in. And you enter through this very gentle series of steps down into the dining space, so that you're both a video star and also having your runway moment.
Yeah.
Then after that, it's, you know, you sit down and it's a very noisy space, and they, you know, they feed you.
Yeah.
But it's open 24 hours.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those places that you kind of need to know at 4 in the morning when you don't want to really be on the subway.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to hang out. Well, it used to be open 24 hours. I think it probably still is. It was one of the things that was great about Brasserie. And you also have the right, the sort of cafe at the Guggenheim Museum. So you've got some new stuff in here also.
Yeah. Yeah, I figure the Guggenheim will have that around a little bit.
Now, I mean, when it came to your research, and you mentioned landscape, you've included one of my favorites, Balsley Park.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you find out the history of what Tom Balsley had done?
Well, some of it was books, things like the Gerald Caden's privately owned public spaces book, where he thoroughly documents, all the various spaces, primarily in Manhattan, that this is one of them. And partly through my writing and so on, I would just kind of... let me just back up a minute. I mean, with researching the book, I didn't want to talk to architects too much, because, you know, I know architects are always going to be biased about their work and painted in the best possible light. But, you know, there were occasions when I just, for whatever in my writing, I would end up talking to them and learn about projects that I wouldn't otherwise know about. I don't know if Balsley Park was one of those. I think that was one I just came across.
As for me, I only knew that it was named after Tom Balsley because I've known Tom Balsley for 30 years on and off.
Mm-hmm.
And when the park was named for him, I thought it was just incredibly cool.
Yeah. I mean, supposedly he's done 50 or so of these privately owned public spaces. And there was one in, I used to work at 29th and 6th Avenue, and he did one near there that had a very similar palette, kind of this bright corrugated metal walls, cutouts, and so on, nice plantings.
Right.
So I kind of put two and two together when I would be at lunch and then kind of found myself west of Columbus Circle seeing this other one that happened to have his name.
Well, that's at 57th and 8th Avenue, 9th Avenue.
9th, yeah, because it's actually part of the building, I think, next to Hearst Tower.
It's part of the Sheffield development,
It's very removed from it.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Sheffield some other time. What a disaster. And then again, you're not afraid to talk about here. Here's a townhouse on West 75th Street between Broadway and Weston Avenue, which has a sunscreen. But as you note, it's north facing.
Right.
So it to me, I mean, you didn't go the next step and say, what's it hiding from? You're very polite here and say, well, it gives him some privacy.
Right.
To me, it looks like a building that's doing peekaboo. It's like, what are you hiding behind here? I mean, your next door neighbor's got a big bay window, and they're not hiding.
Yeah. I've been doing with my book. I've actually been doing some walking tours, and an obvious place where I've done them, the most popular ones are along the High Line. And
yeah,
I can't help but talk about, say, the metal shutter houses by Shigeru Ban and the Hotel Americano, which is maybe 8 or 10 blocks north of Shigeru Ban's, where they both have these, one is a perforated metal and one is a metal mesh, but they both face north. So, you know, it's kind of image making, but it, when I look at it, I think this filters light. You know, there must be a reason beyond just marketing and, you know, creating a strong image. But I think when they're north-facing, that's what prevails.
Unless they're doing some kind of light shelf thing that's extremely clever. I wonder.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been involved in a building that had a sunscreen on the north side.
Right.
I guess the Times, which was designed by Renzo Piano, has got the baguettes on all four sides.
Yeah,
but that's a building that wants to have bilateral symmetry,
right?
Just simply because it's a tower of a certain sort. You know, it's not like the Bank of America, which is a crystalline shape.
Yeah,
it's a four square tower. No, I'm really highly impressed that you've really done your research. I mean, you mentioned in passing the development on page 129 of the Upper West Side, including the village of Bloomingdale. Now, I moved to Bloomingdale about a year ago, and I didn't know about the. I mean, I went to college here in New York City. I took city planning in Manhattan, and no one ever mentioned Bloomingdale. I didn't know about Bloomingdale till I moved to Bloomingdale.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talk about the development of the 9th Avenue trains. I thought, oh, good for you. I mean,
well, yeah,
did some digging.
Yeah, and I think with the urban design, urban planning experience, or at least experience in school, I couldn't just talk about individual buildings. I wanted to put them in some sort of context.
Right.
And the same with wanting to talk about landscapes. And, because in a lot of cases, especially the industrial waterfronts now, they're huge. I mean, they're part of the reason that you have, say, these Richard Meyer Towers or other projects, you know, with this proximity is because, you know, instead of this industrial waterfront, you have parkland that they can use, overlook, and so on. So there's a strong relationship between these larger urban projects and individual buildings.
And I'm glad that you're doing that, because the evolving nature of the built environment, especially in Manhattan, is one of the abandonment of industrial built environment, and then its eventual rediscovery and repurposing. Now, in the case of the Meyer Lofts, they tore something down and they put up the glass towers. Across the street, just south of that, there had been a warehouse, and I'm working with my current practice, and we're putting residences on top of the warehouse, with a kind of son of Sterrett Lehigh, you know, the Sterrett Lehigh building. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not contemporary, but it's still part of the whole West Side greatest hits, even though it's like from 1927. Mm-hmm. And we didn't just wipe it out and put a tower in a park. We had a different point of view.
Yeah.
But the migration from a city that's purposeful in terms of industry and worker housing to a city that is mostly housing, but incidentally may have some industry interspersed with office towers is interesting to me. Perhaps towards the end of our time, we could talk about what might happen to New York if some of the dire prognostications of Jim Kunstler, you know, James Howard Kunstler.
I read some of his Emergency and other books.
We talked about his latest book, Too Much Magic, about a month ago.
That one I'm not familiar with.
It's just out now. There's nothing really new. It's what happens or why does the long emergency happen?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of elaborated footnotes for the long emergency. But if the long emergency is actually happening, what does that mean for cities like New York, especially for Manhattan, which is landlocked and doesn't have all that much watercraft access anymore?
Right.
That could be kind of interesting to see how that plays out. Let's see. Now, you know what? I don't want to do another musical break because I don't have any good music to play. One of the things that I think is interesting to me when I read a book like this, just speaking as an architect. By the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with John Hill, architect and author of the Guide to Contemporary New York City Architecture, which is just out in the bookstores late last year. As I look at these different projects, I myself come to wonder how the various architectural practices got these commissions. I think there's a whole interesting story. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're looking at 40 Bond Street, Herzog and de Meuron, well, they had an international practice, and I don't know how it was at the... I think this was developed by Ian Schrager.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know how Schrager found them other than he just saw their stuff somewhere and thought they were cool and just decided that they should do a project for him.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But then in other cases, let's see, project or page 142. Let's see if it's project 142. Yeah, the Marcy Avenue Residence by Jonathan Kirschenfeld. I did some work with Jonathan.
Okay.
And I know that his practice is pretty much founded on Jonathan's own research into marginal lots in sketchy neighborhoods that would be of a size that would permit redevelopment for assisted living.
Yeah.
Or projects like those developed by Common Ground Collaborative.
Yeah.
And he did do one project which wasn't finished in time for your book, which you probably would have included, on St. Mark's Avenue that I worked on.
Is that the one with the cow wall and light well?
Yeah,
it's that one. That one, I'm not sure if there's public access to that space. I mean, when I see photos, I think, oh, got to get in there. That's what you'd want to see with a guidebook. You'd want to get into that.
But you can't because the people who live there are elderly and formerly homeless, and they're kind of emotionally fragile, and so therefore it's unfortunately you can't really see the court with the yellow pavilion at the end of it, which is clad in a Betty Laminati rain screen.
Okay.
Italian plastic, basically. I mean, it's a beautiful looking little thing, and I detailed the rain screen, and I haven't been able to go back there and see it once it was really finally finished.
Yeah.
So to your point, you were covering projects that are easily accessible.
Yeah, and actually, with Kirschenfeld was one of the architects that, to kind of step back a little bit in terms of how the book was made, I mean, I did have an advance, but it wasn't enough to, say, have a photography budget. So in a lot of cases, I would contact architects to say, do you have the rights to publish these in my book? Can you give me these photos? And it all depended, but, you know, in a lot of cases, that was an opportunity for the architects to kind of say, do you know about this one? Because I would usually be in touch about one in particular. And that, when I was in touch with him about Marcy, he did let me know about Bronx Park East, which, you know, then I went up and visited it. And, you know, I liked it formally, but also just the way he manipulated that irregular site, which I think you were talking about.
Is that in here, too?
Yeah.
I missed that.
And that was with Bronx Park East, I think I was able to talk about his series of housing for irregular sites, quote unquote. And I actually saw him as part of a panel discussion last week, and he talked about the St. Mark's one in some detail, but all of these irregular site projects together. And in terms of getting a job, he's very unique in finding a site, developing a proposal.
Then he finds a developer.
Yeah.
Right.
Which, you know, there's always been this ethical dilemma of, you know, architects as developers, and he's not a developer, but he's more proactive in terms of what he's doing rather than sitting back and waiting for somebody to find him.
And I think that's good.
Yeah.
Because these sites would ordinarily not be identified by a not-for-profit development organization because they don't have the resources to be looking like that.
Yeah.
But all of the others, and it's like Alex Gorlin, you know, how did he find his way to Common Ground? And I would love an update to Giorgio Vasari's Lives of the Artists, but talking about how commissions happen to happen in the 21st century. I think that would be really interesting.
I mean, I wonder if it's changed, you know, speaking 21st. I mean, I think, you know, I do work with a website where there's some marketing and it's online, but, you know, I think it's still meeting people face-to-face, that kind of maybe slower route of just getting to know them and, you know, personal networking and so on. But, you know, I would think that that's still prevalent, you know.
There is a certain amount of patronage. Without revealing any trade secrets, I can tell you that Bob Fox, formerly of Fox Fowl, now at Cook Plus Fox, worked for Emery Roth in the 1960s, and when the Roth Empire, when Emery Roth was gone, and it was the heirs, that practice fell apart a bit, and through that, Bob Fox got to know people in the Durst organization, and one thing led to another, and he did four Times Square, and they liked the work that he did, and then he became one of the leading lights of the Good Green movement, and the Dursts saw the wisdom in that and asked him to do One Bryant Park, the Bank of America headquarters. And so in a way, they are patrons. It's not to say that Bob's not a good architect, because he is, and he really knows his stuff when it comes to very large buildings and all of the very good green practice aspects that can be incorporated into a very large building. But still, on a certain level, it's hard to argue that some of the real estate families in New York City are not like the Medici's commissioning projects, which can lead to excellent architecture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there must be some reason that Durst, say, Durst is the West 57th development, right?
Yes.
The Bjark Ingels. I mean, there must be a reason he went with.
I haven't found Bjark out. Ingels I haven't found. I haven't found out yet why they wanted Bjarke to do that project.
Mm-hmm.
I have been promised by Bjarke himself and his assistant that he will be coming here in September. And
oh,
we can ask him that. You could sit in. provided you promise to drink Danish beer with us.
Oh. Of course.
Yes, of course. To say Bjarke throws the best office parties. I count myself as an acquaintance, but Bjarke has about 10,000 best friends. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did get an invite to one, but I was out of town when it happened. One of the parties.
Sorry you missed that. Anyway, we'll ask Bjarke when he comes around again. So, I mean, looking forward, are you going to come back to architecture? What kind of architecture do you want to do?
I mean, not that I have time to think about it or to dwell on it or to wonder, but, you know, every now and then, you know, a lot of times it's talking with people and kind of them having that question, and I think, you know, I have the equivalent of, say, 12 years experience kind of split, not evenly, but split amongst Chicago and New York. And, you know, I feel now I would not go work for a firm. I would probably just find a way to get my license, say, if I'm still here, you know, in New York, get it here, maybe do the legwork and not give NCARB a $5,000 check or whatever it is. And just kind of do something, you know, myself. So what jobs, I don't know. You know, I haven't really thought that much about it. But I think one thing with writing is there's a high level of independence.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
You know, I know it's different in, you know, architecture. I mean, there's always a client. There's always going to be somebody who's making those decisions that you're kind of, you know, you're developing a design for, but, you know, to then just go into an office and be an employee, I don't see that happening.
Well, if you don't mind my placing a pointed question, I mean, is this a living for you, what you've been doing?
It's good right now. I mean, you know, I'm not, it's not just me, my wife is an architect as well. I mean, she's, you know, well, she's not practicing at the moment either, but she's,
but you know. Between you and she, you're able to support yourself and your child and,
yeah.
And pay your rent.
Yeah.
And you seem pretty relaxed about it.
It comes and goes.
And
you know, there's obviously times being self-employed that, you know,
yeah, of course.
You wish that, you know, whatever Kay's health insurance, for example.
That's
you know,
a problem.
You wish that was taken care of. But, you know, it's working for now. And, you know, I think since 2008, 2009, it's been a little experiment of sorts. And, you know, it's kind of not something I see indefinitely. But I see that as I move forward, more and more opportunities happen. So, you know, I think there's other avenues that I could go into that are architectural, that may or may not be practice, but, you know, would be other means of income.
Sure, that's understood. For almost 5 years, I did very well, and I learned a great deal. Working in a consulting firm that did due diligence services on behalf of construction lenders, where we vetted projects, other people's work.
Mm-hmm.
We examined the plans, the specs. We looked at all of the contracts. We looked at the schedules. We looked at the budgets. We tried to box the risk for the lenders and identify anything that was not well-defined or unreasonable that might represent extra cost, because, as you know, until the note's paid back, the lenders own the project.
Right.
And that was excellent, because I was able to have involvement in about 400 projects in five years.
Okay.
Either I walked them myself, or I analyzed them myself, or I was a reviewer, a second-party reviewer for the primary reviewer in the firm, keeping track of the people that I was managing. Mm-hmm. And it was excellent in terms of seeing how other people solved architectural problems.
Okay.
And then also, when you're inspecting a construction project and the lenders want to come along because everyone's all fascinated by construction, and they ask you, what's that? You had better have an answer.
Yeah.
And that is one allied sort of job that requires a high degree of architectural experience that's not architectural practice.
Yeah.
Now, do you think having an urban design background gives you an advantage because you're thinking in terms of a larger context?
Maybe. I mean, I think when I decided to go into the urban design program at City College, I was working on, say, some green buildings in Chicago, I just felt like, if these green buildings are being inserted into, say, a car-dependent context, what's the point? There needs to be some thinking of this larger scale. And, it's not like it was anything unique, in terms of what I was saying. I think a lot of people are thinking that way, going that route. And
you mean the anti-car route?
Well, anti-car, or just thinking more in terms of sustainable development, or, whatever you want to call it, but just, thinking of the larger context, be it architects, landscape architects, or whatever you think urban designers do, if they're, kind of the glue holding them all together, or directing, or kind of mediating, whatever the case. But, currently it's been, more in terms of how I, say, write or research. But if it were something where, my design skills could be on that scale, I think that would be great. I like the idea of that.
But you'd be raising urban design issues as an architect.
Yeah.
Because originally the urban designers, aside from Robert Moses, were architects.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole, when it was, CERT and everybody.
Sure.
There was kind of a, I think there were landscape architects. I don't know when, but I mean, there's actually a book I read that had, it was on urban design. It might have been the those Harvard readers that came out about it. But whatever the case, there was one essay that looked at that and just saw how, maybe there was two ways of going about it, landscape versus architecture.
You mean the Harvard Design Journal?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, that might be one reason that kind of landscape urbanism has, kind of grown in some popularity, or been kind of a counter proposal to the architect's way of dealing with urban design.
Right.
Because they were excluded from the early decades.
Well, I think, reading an essay by Jane Jacobs that was reissued, and I can't remember where, I spoke about it on an episode here on Burning Down the House about 2 months ago. Something that goes back to the early 60s, and she talks about the difference between the urban texture that naturally evolves with buildings of different ages versus the architects of that era putting a tower in a plaza that nobody walks through and calling it urban design. And she was a big fan of some of the back streets, say in San Francisco, where there were newer buildings and older buildings. The scale was different. The older buildings were a place where you could have bookstores or antique stores that didn't have to pay a lot of rent, because if they had to pay a lot of rent, they wouldn't be in a new building.
Yeah.
And how that differed from the grand scheme of, I'm going to wipe it all out and replace it with towers and plazas and superhighways running past it, and then you swoop past the building, and then you park in the parking garage, and then you never walk through the plaza.
Yeah.
Thankfully, predated my architectural education, mm-hmm. and so I'm fully in her camp.
Okay.
And I'm glad that she wrote what she did, because it was very clear. And I'm glad that you've written your guide, because there's just a lot of really good stuff in here.
Thanks.
And I salute your effort. And by the way, it's a beautiful book.
Yeah. I mean, the designers. I actually, when I did the proposal, I had done a little graphic design. I did sample pages, maps, basically part of one chapter, and looked at, you know, do projects get one page, a half page, 2 pages, and developed a structure. And this was in the early process, and eventually got carried through the book. But thankfully, the designers, these guys, Modern Good, out of Philadelphia, they didn't make it so rigid. They followed it, because that was kind of how these spreads and other things were going to fall in the book, within the pages, but they varied the white space. They varied the placing of the photos and so on. So thankfully, they didn't take mine too literally, but they did a good job.
It smells good, too. So we're just about out of time. Yeah. If you have any parting wisdom that you'd like to give us, or the URLs of your different blogs, you could flog them right now.
Okay. I mean, if you go to www.archidos.org, you can find the various web pages there. The daily one is archidos.blogspot.com. And Architourist, which was kind of definitely a, you know, it's not a page that I've contributed to a lot in the last few years. I haven't really been traveling outside of New York. But anyways, I think that one is pbworks.architourist.com. But yeah, they're all there at archidos.org.
Thank you. Super. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We've been talking with John Hill, architect and writer. Life's a long song, and I hope that we can continue our conversation sometime in the future.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much. Carlos, let's go out with track 6, please.
When you're falling awake and you take stock of the new day, and you hear your voice croak as you choke on what you need to say. Well, don't you fret, don't you fear, I will give you good cheer. Life's a long song. Life's a long song.